last night. Chris Middleton and John Henson added 17 points apiece for the Bucks. Milwaukee has won 3 straight games. Freezing fog is possible throughout the entire state today, especially in low-lying areas during the morning. Highs today will be in the mid to upper 30s in the north. It should be in the upper 30s to low 40s in southern Wisconsin. Cloudy skies will move in with developing rain showers from the northwest to the southeast after 4 o'clock this afternoon and should last through tomorrow morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Trader Joe's, featuring a variety of products for holiday tables, including turkeys, stuffing, and Trader Joe's turkey and stuffing seasoned kettle chips for the flavors of Thanksgiving in a potato chip. More at TraderJoe's.com.
Support for WPR comes from The Ridges in Bailey's Harbor, Door County, celebrating its 80th anniversary, open year-round. Now featuring a 1/3 mile accessible boardwalk. Information is at ridgessanctuary.org. Support also comes from Pines Bach, an independent law firm with deep Madison roots and attorneys who are dedicated to being a trusted resource, committed to providing personal service and positive outcomes. On the web at pinesbach.com.
It can be annoying when someone uses so many ums in conversation. What's happening when these words are sprinkled in our conversation? What is putting constraints on how we talk and when we speak up in conversation? Nick Enfield studies the ins and outs of conversation. He is a professor of linguistics at the University of Sydney and directs the Sydney Social Sciences and Humanities Advanced Research Center. His new book is How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. It's out today. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, we get a whole lot of listener mail here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and on a regular basis, we get feedback from listeners who say they're hearing too many ums, likes, mm-hmms. What should be our comeback line?
Our comeback line should be that these are necessary parts of a functional language system. It's not easy to do away with these things, and there's plenty of good reasons why we have them.
So what are these necessary reasons that they're in our speech? They're annoying, right?
Yeah, they are kind of annoying in a certain sense. But when you think about it and when you study language as it's used, you find that they have a function. And the function of them makes sense when you look at language not just as being something that individuals produce, but as being a kind of a joint activity, if you like. So in my work and in the new book, I really focus on this sort of joint activity function of language. And when you look at language like that, you realize that words like and are not just sort of rubbish syllables. What they're actually doing is sending a message to the other person that gives them information such as, please hold on a second. I'm processing what I want to say. I'm not ready to yield the floor over to you, and so forth. So these are actually what I call little traffic signals that allow ultimately conversation to run off much more smoothly than it otherwise might do.
And these traffic signals, they're doing some heavy lifting if they're insinuating some other things going on in the conversation.
Yeah, I guess they are. I mean, one of the things about language in general is obviously it's a way of signaling to others what's going on in your head. You know, we can't mind read, so we use language to express ourselves, to let other people know what we want and what we think. And at the same time, we also need to be able to give them information about our actual processing of language itself. So you're sort of conveying language on more than one level. And the thing is that language itself is really quite hard work to process. There's a lot of brain power being devoted to it. There's a lot of effort involved in going and getting the words from those parts of our brains that hold words and so forth. So there's a lot going on at one time, and you really need to be able to let the other person know when things are going smoothly and when they're not. And that way the other person knows in a regular conversation whether they should just hold off in jumping in with their little bit. I mean, when you're listening on the radio, it's a little bit different, obviously, because you're not conversing with that person, and you wish that they had perfect capacity to produce language, but none of us do. And these little traffic signals, as you say, do pretty heavy lifting through signaling that.
Why do some people use these filler words more often, and in some cases way more often than other people?
Well, I think one part of the answer to that is simply that there are pretty significant personal individual differences between people in terms of just how fluent they are and how skilled they are at putting sentences together and putting their kind of discourse together. And so it's not just that certain people have the bad habit of using arm and arm more than other people. The reason for using those words is because you are not quite ready with the next thing that you want to say, essentially. And so when people don't use those words very much, it means that they've, you know, achieved a bit more skill, I would say, in terms of being on top of their production of the next sentence coming through. And other people, you know, they need to go to a little bit more effort. It could, of course, have to do with what it is that they're talking about. So if you're talking about something that is difficult to put into words, that's precisely when you find that people will use arm and arm more often, not surprisingly. So, you know, when you compare people on that sort of measure of how much of the time they use arm and arm, you also want to know, well, what's the topic they're talking about? Is it something that they're comfortable talking about, something that they know a lot about, or is it something that they're having kind of trouble putting into words?
Interesting you say that, because former President Obama became somewhat famous for his uhs. A few years ago, The Late Show with David Letterman had a lot of fun with President Obama's at his expense. They did a feature called Barack Obama Count, in which they counted and spliced together all the uhs he did in a single interview. And there were about 30 of them. There was also a scoring mechanism. What does that say, for how we process language and how a president is using uhs?
Well, I think it shows that nobody's perfect. You know, Obama's a good example. He, you know, is obviously famous for being a good public speaker and being highly eloquent and that sort of thing. Although, just as you say, he's also famous for producing and ah a lot. That's something that you can have fun with at pretty much anybody's expense. And, you know, the producers of The Daily Show are perfectly aware of that. They'd be happy for other people to poke fun at them as well. So, you know, I think that it's not necessarily telling us anything specific about Obama. And I guess that one of the other aspects of our personal individual differences is that others of us might reach for other kinds of traffic signals, if you like, to rely on a little bit more often. You know, there are other things apart from arm. We have, you know, we have like, these things mean slightly different things, but different people might rely on them to sort of different extents.
Nick Enfield is with us. He studies the ins and outs of conversation. He is a linguistics professor at the University of Sydney. His new book out today is How We Talk, the Inner Workings of Conversation. You can join this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you get annoyed when people use filler words or pauses in their conversation? Do you catch yourself using filler words like and or like, and you try to stop yourself? What questions do you have about how people talk? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick, you were involved in a recent study that showed the word huh exists in every language. Is it used the same way all around the world?
In its core function, yeah, it is used in the same way all around the world. Perhaps surprisingly, there are not very many words in the languages of the world that sound the same and have the same meaning. And we were pretty surprised to find that that's exactly what we get with the word huh. it has different functions in English, depending a little bit on how you pronounce it. If you say, huh, that means one thing. If you say, huh, that means another thing. And the function that we focused on was the first one. It's the one where you didn't hear or you didn't understand or somehow you couldn't comprehend what the other person just said, and you say, huh? And they will either repeat exactly what they said, or they might rephrase a little bit, put in a new word, or reformulate what they're saying. That's the function that we find across the world. And if you get out your tape recorder and record a natural conversation, you'll find pretty quickly that people will use a word that sounds close to huh with exactly that function.
And you also note that animals don't have a version of huh in animal language.
Well, that's right. That's an interesting and complex question. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people would say there is no such thing as animal language, or if you talk about animal language, you're using the word language in another kind of sense.
Context. Obviously,
Well, obviously animals communicate in complex ways, and they have quite subtle ways of communicating and other not so subtle ways of communicating. One of the things about animal communication is that, you know, not all of the animals have conversations in the same sense that we mean them. And in the book, I really explore that kind of question, and I look at a few examples, some of the primates that have forms of communication which look like sort of turn-taking. They're often referred to as duetting. We obviously have that in some bird species as well, where one individual will produce a certain type of call and the other one will produce another type of call in response. Those are pretty complex and certainly very interesting forms of vocal communication, but we don't find any evidence that one individual in one of those kinds of exchanges will stop the other one with some sort of signal and say, hey, I missed what you just did, or was the thing you just did what you actually intended? Because you go back and redo it.
And I'm going to just pause right there as we head into a news update. We're with Nick Enfield, the author of How We Talk. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you get annoyed when people use filler words or pauses? Join in. We'll be return after a news update. You might know these filler words like, you know, I mean, they're part of our everyday lives in conversation. We expect them. Recall President Obama, a typically eloquent speaker. There were counters made around his speech patterns and his use of We're learning about these nuances of speaking spontaneously off the cuff in conversation. University of Sydney linguistics professor Nick Enfield is with us. His new book is How We Talk. Your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Do you catch yourself using these filler words? Are you aware of using them? Have you tried to break yourself of them? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Edgerton. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
The show. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The more I do public speaking, I give sermons every now and then at church, and my daughter's kept a list of how many times I say, like I just did, or ah, and it's really made me aware of how I speak. Just a comment.
And so have you found yourself, as you become more aware, Jim, have your speech patterns changed?
They have, yeah. I catch myself now. I'm thinking ahead before I speak.
Nick, is this true that when people start really focusing, observing it, their speech may change?
Absolutely true. Yeah, I think that's a great story from Jim that, you know, as soon as you become more conscious of what you're doing, then you can definitely achieve greater fluency in that sense. And I think it's certainly appropriate to those public speaking contexts where, for example, if you're giving a sermon or if you're giving, you know, a turn in a debate or what have you, people aren't going to come in and interrupt you, or they're not going to wonder when it's their turn to talk because you're, you know, busy with what's essentially a kind of a monologue. So people really just want it to sound nice and fluent. The thing is, if you're in a sort of free-flowing conversation like we're sort of in now, or like you might be in at the breakfast table, the ums and ahs actually do give important information. So one of the things that's really interesting I talk about in the book is the difference between and ah. We talk about these two words, and Jim mentioned both of them as being kind of distinct. And what's interesting there is that they actually signal a slightly different thing. The always occurs before a slightly longer bit of disfluency or a slightly longer time before the speaker resumes than the R does. So the R signals a slightly shorter or less kind of significant break or significant kind of impediment to what the person's saying. So those things in the to and fro of conversation, where we're really trying to kind of organize the dance of language, if you like, they play a much more important role. But in the public speaking context, the idea of sort of cutting them out from your speech is certainly possible and advisable. It definitely comes across very well.
Jim, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Bob in La Crosse. Hi, Bob.
Hello. One of the conjunctives that I think is overused and I think misused today is the word so, S-O, which could be a conjunctive. She went to the store so she could buy food. But many of the newscasters and everybody else is using so to start a sentence. How's it going in Washington? And the reporter will respond, so, and it just seems inappropriate to me. It is one of those conjunctive words that you can use in connection with so or so well or whatever, but to start a sentence, it just seems inappropriate or improper. It's sort of replaced the old word well. Well, I used to do that. Now it's so this and that.
Nick, how does so fit into this linguistics thread here?
Well, I think so would fit in with many of those other words that Bob's also just mentioned that serve a function of what I call in the book traffic signals. And what's interesting about what Bob's saying is that there's change taking place in the language, and this is something that always comes up in discussion with linguists and with people in the general population when they talk about language. There's very often a sense that people are unhappy with a habit that perhaps younger people or people from a different part of the country are using, and people will often say, well, this is the proper usage and people aren't using it for its proper use. This is really an inevitable sort of aspect of language, and it's simply the fact of language change. So a word like so being used now in this other way that Bob just described, we might say it replaces something like well. We could say that it's wrong because it doesn't fit that former function that we're used to, but we also could say it's just the language changing in a natural kind of way, and this is a new meaning and a new function for the word. And when we teach linguistics to undergrads at university, this is one of the kind of main lessons we give them is that language changes and there's very little you can do about it, and in fact what the best thing to do is to try to kind of embrace it and understand it. These kinds of words, I spend a lot of time talking about them in the book. They are pretty hard to understand. They're much harder than a lot of other aspects of language. And the reason for that is that they're used in free-flowing conversation. They don't tend to be used in written language, which, of course, is easier to poke and prod at. Spoken language is much harder to kind of pin down. And that's why these words tend to be quite hard to understand, but nevertheless very important.
Bob, thanks for the observation. Thanks for calling in. I suppose, Nick, we need to become more flexible with how words are. You write about the norms of conversation, that if someone asks a question, we should answer it. And if we can't answer it, we should give some kind of response. And if somebody else has asked a question, we shouldn't answer for them. Those may sound like basic, simple good manners, but you insist there's more to it. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that when we're using language, we're not just, you know, individuals who are producing sentences. You know, I say something to you, I ask you something. Using language in a conversation is really what I referred to earlier as a kind of joint action. And humans have a very special sort of social awareness and social cognition that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book. And it's a kind of social cognition that requires the people involved to have a joint, what we call a joint commitment to the interaction that's taking place. So it's just like when, for example, you go for a walk together with somebody, I can't just, without announcing or accounting for myself, suddenly veer off in the opposite direction or just stand still and let you walk ahead of me. In a sense, what we've done when we take a walk together is we've made a commitment to each other to follow through to that sort of joint goal. And conversation is basically the same as this, but, you know, different in some certain interesting ways. And asking a question is a good example of this. If I say to you, you know, what's the time? You really are under a kind of what I refer to as a moral obligation to deal with my question. If you walk away, if you ignore me, I can hold you to account for that. And then we certainly see that if you record conversations, people will say things like, hey, I asked you a question. And I give examples of this in the book where people get quite, you know, upset, or they certainly, you know, insist on their right to have their question responded to. And similarly, I give examples where, you know, I ask you a question and a third person responds and I say, well, hang on, I didn't ask you. And these are familiar things to all of us, I think, from our daily experience with conversation. And they show that really there's a sense of this joint commitment and teamwork, if you like, that there's maybe a little bit under the radar when we use language. But if you look at it from an observer's point of view, you can very clearly see that's how people are orienting to conversation.
If you're just joining us, we're with Nick Enfield. He's a linguistics professor at the University of Sydney. His new book out today is How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. Join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how people talk? Is a conversation a pact? Is it teamwork, as Nick says? Do you contemplate pauses and intonation? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Barb now in Green Bay. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Well, Nick has answered a bit of my question already, but I'm just wondering if the umming and ahhing has increased recently in history because of all the divisive conversations and people possibly just trying to hold on to their place in the conversation before they're interrupted by someone who vehemently disagrees with them.
Nick, divisiveness and our use of these filler words.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question from Barb. You know, I'm not sure whether the frequency of use of things like um and ah has changed over time, and it's a really interesting question that we could potentially look at. The problem with these things, of course, is that it's hard for us to get good data on these things going back into history. We have all of this wonderful sound recordings of people's conversations in recent years, but, you know, going back further in time, we only have the written word. In terms of divisiveness, you know, I think that's a really interesting question, and I emphasized just before the fact that being in a conversation is a kind of pact that we have together with others. We sign up for the conversation in a certain informal sense, and we agree to play our role, we listen, we respond. That can break down if it's a very divisive or competitive sort of interaction, but we really do regard that as a total breakdown if people start just talking over each other. So there's an interesting sense in which conversation is like competitive sport. If you look at a tennis match, you know, it's obviously, you know, each player kind of takes their turn at hitting the ball, but it's not as if we wouldn't usually think of that as a cooperative thing. You know, if you've got two tennis players going at it, it's highly competitive. But on the other hand, if you look at it and compare it to, for example, how, you know, animals might compete with each other, Things like tennis are actually highly cooperative in the sense that the two individuals agree to abide by the rules of the game. And although they could physically, you know, do other things, they could jump over the net and whack the other person on the head with the racket, they don't do that because that's not part of the rules. So within those rules, they can be very competitive, they can be very divisive, if you like, and but that they still agree to stick to the rules. And in conversation, we see similar things. So even if we're having an argument, if it's very heated, we'll still see that people will tend to wait until the right moment comes for them to take their turn at talk. They will use the traffic signals that I describe in the book to signal that the turn is not quite done yet, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure that the divisiveness of an interaction is going to necessarily change the basic ground rules that the conversation works under.
Barb, appreciate the question. Nick, just as in tennis, the ball might be going 80 miles an hour over the net, you actually looked at the timing of switching between speakers and how tight that is, about a second from the time one person stops when the other person goes. Most of us, we never think about how much time it takes for the interaction in the conversation. Can you tell us what's going on there and the milliseconds we're talking about?
Yeah, well, people who study the way that we use language have got ways to very finely time the processes that are involved. And as you say, it comes down to the milliseconds. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on in our brains when we talk. Right now I'm talking, I have to, you know, go and select words from a certain part of my brain or my mind. I've got to send signals to my vocal apparatus and execute these motor programs. It's taking place very, very fast. When we are in a conversation, there's added on top of this is the whole sort of all the considerations around switching back and forth from one speaker to the next. So I give quite a lot of attention to this problem in the book. And I describe the work that I did with many colleagues where what we did was we went out to different parts of the world, all over the world, not just in English or you know, European languages, but languages from places like Ghana and New Guinea and Laos. And we just recorded free-flowing conversation and then sat down and timed very carefully the amount of time that would pass between we focused on questions and looked at exactly how many milliseconds passed between the end of someone's question and the beginning of someone's response to that question. And you just mentioned the measure of 1 second. There is something that I talk about, refer to in one chapter that's called the 1 second window in conversation, that is a sort of a maximum time that we would let pass before we would decide that actually something's gone wrong and we need to rephrase our question or check if the person actually heard us. But in a free-flowing, smoothly flowing conversation, the transition time between one speaker and the next is actually a lot faster than that. And the grand average for the languages that we have a measure of is around about a bit over 200 milliseconds, which is about the same time as it takes to blink the eye. So what you find is that people respond to questions on average in a way that is extremely smooth. It doesn't actually sound to us as if there's any gap at all, but if you measure it, you'll find that there is just that very tiny gap, and it shows that people are not only very fast, but what they're really doing in conversation is carefully monitoring what the other person is saying and actually showing the possibility of predicting, or what we call projecting, the timing of the end of the question, so that we tend to launch our responses even before the other person is finished.
Oh, so there's almost like this dance going on, and it's almost a little bit of a choreographed dance in conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how it sort of comes across. But the most interesting thing here is when you say it's a choreographed dance, the thing about choreography and dance is that it's planned from in advance, right? You choreograph the dance and then you practice it and then you run through it. And it's the same with duets in songs and that kind of thing. The amazing thing about human conversation is that it's not prescripted. We don't know who's going to say what. We don't know how long they're going to talk for. We don't know who's going to, you know, what order the different people are going to talk in. And so it comes across as a choreographed dance, but amazingly, it's one that's completely unscripted. So it's more like sort of improvised jazz, if you like.
We're breaking apart conversations and how they work with Nick Enfield and jumping in on his conversation there. He's a linguistics professor at the University of Sydney. His new book is How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation. Join in 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how people talk? Filler words used, do you contemplate pauses, intonation? 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update.
All those things override a guilt by association, some of these issues.
The Late Show with David Letterman had a fun at making fun at President Obama's expense. They did a feature called Barack Obama A Count, in which they counted and spliced together all the uhs he did in a single interview. Turns out they have a deeper meaning in unlocking what we know about conversation. Not only are these filler words inevitable, it's possible they're actually a useful part of understanding our linguistic evolution, which is what Nick Enfield thinks about a lot as a linguistics professor at the University of Sydney. His new book is How We Talk, The Inner Workings of Conversation.